You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Italy votes on Sunday, but when will we figure out who won? My guests Henry Rees-Sheridan, Carlotta Rebello and Chiara Ramella will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including American corporations doing what the government won't when it comes to taking on the gun lobby, whose passport can beat up whose passport, and... Penguins. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Carlotta Rebello, Henry Rees-Sheridan and Chiara Ramella. Just to be clear, there will be no actual live penguins in the studio at the risk of disappointing listeners. That would just be bizarre and somewhat cruel. And to the Penguins as well. We will start in Italy, which votes in a general election on Sunday. Nobody has any idea what's going to happen, partly because of the pre-election poll blackout Italy imposes, partly because of a new voting system that is being tried out, and mostly because nobody ever knows what's going to happen in Italian elections. Indeed, it often takes a while afterwards to figure out what has actually happened in Italian elections. Chiara, you are here once again speaking on behalf of an entire nation. Who's going to win?
Well, and now here's the time when I reveal that I've known all along. No, nobody knows is the real answer, obviously. It's complicated, partly because of the par condicio. As you mentioned, 2 weeks before the elections, official polls stop, so we don't really know where that leaves us. And just before this two-week period, actually, even I think the most striking and interesting point of closeness between two parties was the one between Berlusconi's own Forza Italia and its close allies, La Lega, who are the xenophobes, kind of right-wing allies, who were separated only by 4 percentage points. Meaning that if that difference was to be overcome, we could be looking at a potential prime minister, if the centre-right coalition makes it, that is a very extremist right-wing politician. And I think that, for me, would be the worst-case scenario, obviously.
Henry, do you struggle with the common incomprehension of Italian elections from outside, or is there some sort of clarity of vision you have regarding
I think I'm probably even below average in terms of my comprehension of this phenomenon and most others. Favourite things to be confused about include the different age limits for the different Houses of Parliament. One of them you have to be 18 to vote, one of them you have to be 25, which is quite arcane. That's my understanding.
Yes, because the Senate, as the word itself suggests, is senectus, sorry, my Latin's a bit rusty, is obvious.
How dare you?
Yeah, I know. Came unprepared. But it's the house of the people who are older, and so only if you're over 25 you're allowed to vote. Now, it may seem a fact of little consequence, but actually it may prove quite substantial for this election, because it's predicted that young voters will actually come out voting quite a lot more than they have in the past, and traditionally they support either left wing or, in this case, very often the movement Five Stars. So it's the part of the electorate that the centre right doesn't normally really manage to crack. Whilst Berlusconi always goes for the pensioners, that's where he knows he can strike.
Well, you mentioned Berlusconi, and Carlotta, Berlusconi inexplicably is still a thing. It's not just the fact that he is 300 years old, though parts of him are much younger. It's the fact that, you know, there are dozens, hundreds of scandals, and indeed crimes attached to him, any one of which would have sunk anybody else, and yet here he still is.
Oh yeah, like, they're trying to understand how Berlusconi is still alive, both as a person and as a politician, is one of the great challenges of the 21st century. But you spoke about Berlusconi, and last night, the president of the European Parliament, Antonio Tajani, he accepted Berlusconi's offer to be the the Forza Italia's prime ministerial candidate. Because, of course, Berlusconi, because of the tax fraud scandal, can't be the prime minister if Forza Italia miraculously becomes the party that wins the elections. That's just how bad he is in terms of these scandals hitting him. And obviously Berlusconi, he's banned until 2019, but he read that sentence quite, the sentencing quite carefully, and it doesn't say anything about campaigning, and that's why we've been seeing him parading around the country. And now that Tahani has accepted this offer, there will obviously be a huge hole in the European Parliament leadership if he decides to, if the vote goes that way.
I was listening to the British author in Italy, Tim Parks, talk about Berlusconi this morning, and he made two observations. First of all, that there had been relatively little attention paid to the fact that Berlusconi can't, you know, be elected into office because he is a criminal in the Italian media. And the second observation he made...
Is that because Berlusconi owns most of the Italian media?
Well, I mean, this is clarification which I hope to gain. I'm going to field the question to Chiara afterwards. The second observation he made is that Italians are very keen on the letter of the law, not so much on the spirit of the law. And I would like to know from Chiara, is that, first of all, is that a true claim about there not having been much debate about Berlusconi being indicted? Second of all, is that a fair characterisation of Italians?
I don't think there has been much debate because it's a fact that's been very clear to Italians for a very long time. If it had been a surprise or anything that we haven't known for years, maybe we would have debated it. But there's nothing to debate there. It's everybody's fully aware that he's not going to be the presidential candidate. And actually, putting forward Tajani is a really smart move on his point. It's not just finding a puppet that he can sit behind, although naturally that's probably part of it. But actually choosing the president of the European Parliament sets him in a line of aligned with European concerns, and therefore reassures Brussels that he is pro-Europe within a coalition that's largely anti-Europe, and therefore manages to garner support from the European Union. Given that his coalition is now the strongest, he's essentially seen as a safe option. And for somebody like Berlusconi to feel like the safe option for Italy is really quite something. And for him to have mustered this with these decisions, I think is testament to the fact that despite the entire international community thinking he's borderline...
I don't think there's anything borderline about it.
But anyway, you know what I mean. He's not stupid.
There's two things as well that in this whole process have baffled me more than the process itself and how it's been going on. One is last night, the Five Star Movement announced their cabinet already. So it's for the first time in Italian politics, you have a shadow cabinet even before the elections take place. That was even something that Paolo Gentiloni said, which is very bizarre, but it's just to show how on it they are. And the latest polls before the two-week blackout said that they would probably get 28% of the vote, which is not enough for a majority, but still puts them at quite an even standing. And the final thing is just who has just landed in Rome? Steve Bannon, to observe the elections. So I'll just leave you with that thought.
Well, yes, and there is more on the Italian election on the Foreign Desk tomorrow at midday. But let's look now at the United States, which is reminding us this week that there are few spectacles as amusing as the reaction of conservative advocates of free markets to the markets moving against them. Legislators in Georgia are to deny a tax break to Delta Airlines after Delta joined the lengthening list of companies cutting ties with the National Rifle Association following the Valentine's Day shooting at a high school in Florida. Delta is the fifth largest employer in Georgia, for the moment, at least. Henry, how possible does it now seem, and this is getting on for 2 or 3 weeks now, and this is not going away, is it possible that it will be an alliance of corporations and high school kids that actually moves the gun debate?
I think corporations are potentially the most critical factor in shifting the dial in the culture wars.
Because I'm just reminded that there's been incidences of corporations, backing out of states that weren't keen on gay marriage, for example.
So I was at London Pride last year, and the volume of corporate sponsorship has grown now to such an extent that one of the events was sponsored by Ryman's the Stationer, which is a franchise of stationery shops in the UK, which is one, extremely uncool, and second of all, just totally disconnected from anything to do with sexuality, gay rights, minority rights in its actual products and surfaces.
Except
and
to the extent that gay people buy stationery.
Indeed.
As well, obviously.
To my knowledge, to no greater or lesser degree than people of other sexualities.
I do not wish to stereotype anybody with that observation.
My point is, I think that when you see, you know, for if we're going to stick with gay rights, when you see the rainbow flag hanging from the windows of Barclays during Pride Week in a capitalistic society, you pretty much won, haven't you? I think it's a really important sign. And I think that, you know, the symbolic and concrete financial clout of corporations is where perhaps you should be targeting as activists.
But Chiara, why is everybody, well, not everybody, but actually quite a lot of people bailing on the NRA this time when they haven't every other time? And Lord knows there have been any number of opportunities whereby there has been a dreadful gun incident in the United States, followed by the NRA being massive jerks about it.
It's interesting, and I think perhaps it's just an issue of accumulation. I think when you think about the comms and PR occasion for these companies to be doing this right now, I think not that there hasn't been any media relevance to the previous instances of mass shootings, but I think that when it comes to corporations shifting their own practices, there comes a point where, after some start, everybody have to follow in the same way that, for example, companies have started becoming environmentally sustainable. And there is no chance for any company not to be environmentally sustainable now, because that's a paradigm shift that's now happened in all of them. I wonder if it's a case of the paradigm shifting, and from now on for it to be the PR norm for it to hopefully become the PR norm for the companies in the future.
Carlotta, do you think this is actually just an example of the market working as pro-market libertarians always insist it will, that it will arrive eventually at a perfect expression of the popular will? These companies have perceived, after perceiving for a while that being in cahoots with the NRA is a commercial advantage, they're now perceiving it as a commercial disadvantage and changing their minds accordingly.
Yeah, most of these companies that announced they were cutting their ties with the NRA or just simply not renewing existing partnerships, the vast majority of them cited consumer feedback as the reason for this decision. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at the spectrum of these companies, and the list keeps on growing and growing. You have companies, you know, obviously airlines related to travel, rental companies, rent-a-cars. You have tech, security, even a health, like insurers companies. You also have banking. It's like I was reading about the First National Bank, which decided to cut ties with the NRA by simply not renewing the NRA Visa card, which was issued to every member, so that you could, you know, if you were a member of the NRA and you chose this bank, which was one of the biggest in the country, you would have your personalized card, I might assume with a logo or something, and they simply didn't renew that. So from next month, that card won't be in circulation. And I just think, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago here on the same program, about what feels different about the aftermath of this horrible incident, is that you are hearing from the victims. They are older. It's not a parent standing up for them. It's not teachers. These kids are actually able to drive the conversation. Most of them, over 16, they can drive. They can push the rent-a-car companies not to have partnerships with the NRA anymore. And when you have, it started with small rental car companies, and now you have Avis, Budget, Hertz, big company, international names that obviously just looks good for them. And I find the Delta case very interesting, because the immediate response after the law was approved in Georgia to basically eliminate that tax break of about $40 million US dollars was the governors of New York, Connecticut, and probably sure it was Virginia as well, saying, well, move your HQ here. We'll give you that tax break. Kind of a way of...
It would be very amusing if Delta did that.
Yes, and it's a way of the state saying, you know what, we kind of applaud what you just did.
Andrew, I know it's a well-trodden parallel when it comes to evaluating efforts at gun control between Australia and the US.
Yeah.
But when Australia was... going through it. It was an amnesty, wasn't it? A gun amnesty.
It was a gun amnesty, yeah.
I mean,
or it was a buyback, in fact.
A buyback.
You got a certain amount of cash from the government for turning in your weapons.
What was the corporate involvement, if any, in that?
Not very much, as far as I recall, because there wasn't a row about it the same way there always is in the United States. The Prime Minister of the time, John Howard, quite courageously, I thought, given his reliance on the rural vote, made his case. And I think most Australians agreed with it. But as I've said before when this has come up, and, you know, and I have, you know, farmers in my family. I have, you know, friends and relatives who are, you know, gun hobbyists. They're target shooters. But none of them think about guns in the same way that Americans do. They think about guns either as tools, like their axes or chainsaws, or they think of them like they would think of a fishing rod or a tennis racket. They don't actually think of it as part of their identity. And that's why this always becomes a massive, massive thing in the States, I think.
And you know what's interesting on this as well? When it comes to the NRA and what happens after mass shootings in the US is the pro-gun lobbies always talking about the Second Amendment. The reaction to Delta was people saying, well, doesn't that infringe on the First Amendment to use a bill as a punitive way to punish a company for their decision to do something which shouldn't be anyone's respect other than the board of that company? So it's also nice to see, you know, you can't use the same argument for everything all the time.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Chiara Ramello, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Carlotta Ribello. Coming up next, a game of passport top trumps.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing Bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House. Still with me are Henry Rhys Sheridan, Chiara Ramello and Carlotta Ribello. Now, the holders of at least four passports are gathered at this table, specifically those of Portugal, Italy, the United Kingdom and Australia. According to the latest update of the Henley & Partners Passport Index, one of those is among the equal third most powerful passports in the world, two are among the equal fourth most powerful, and one is among the equal sixth. That measurement is based on how many other countries a given passport permits easy access to. Does anyone either want to guess who's won or has already looked up the answers and knows?
I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Look at the smug.
And the reason why.
Said Chiara smugly. Yes, the Italian passport is the equal third most powerful in the world.
With who?
Denmark, Finland, France, Sweden,
no,
Spain.
Somebody's done the research. Chiara, what were the rest again?
No, it was Denmark, Finland, France, Sweden, Spain, South Korea.
Oh, so a few bedfellows then.
Yeah, whereas Portugal and the United Kingdom were tied with others in fourth
Norway,
place.
Australia, Netherlands and Luxembourg.
No, Australia's a bit further down, I think.
Austria.
You're just getting us Austria and Australia just mixed up.
That pleases me greatly.
Just to make you angry, Andrew.
They're two completely different countries.
I know.
One has kangaroos and the other has cakes. That's how you... although...
If you're listening from Australia, don't eat cakes then.
We have excellent cakes in Australia, so we're just
why I get confused.
We're just better than Austria. But I fear we are deviating from the point here. That the actual joint winners were Singapore and Japan. Does that surprise anybody?
Yeah, kind of. This table is calculated purely by counting the number of countries that you can access without a visa. Is that correct?
Something like that.
Something like that. Okay. I just don't... And it's because Uzbekistan gave them visa-free travel, I think. I think that is what tipped them over the edge.
Yeah, the difference to Germany, that used to be the number one, is one country.
I just find it fascinating.
So basically the Uzbeks have stuffed this for Germany. Is that what's happening?
Well, that's my understanding of it. Can anyone...
Yep,
is that what's happened?
Paraguay also lifted visa necessities for Singapore as well, so I guess we have a...
I think Germany should strike now while Uzbekistan is weak.
No, I don't understand. Like, why? What one more country can Portugal get access to than Ireland, for example? Does anyone have any... I just don't understand what forces are at play
year,
here.
Next year, maybe the UK?
Well, indeed. No, and the UK will obviously plummet.
But I did want to ask the panel, and we do have a diverse experience, obviously, of turning up at passport controls with our passport. Do you feel like you're being judged on the basis of it, or people make... Of people have different ideas about you once they make one assumption and then discover another? Because I found myself a couple of times, especially travelling in the Middle East, where most people will assume I'm American or British, that the production of an Australian passport has actually made the conversation suddenly less tense.
I haven't travelled widely enough to have... I just haven't been in regions of the world where it's an issue, I think.
You haven't been to Australia, for example.
Well, yes, indeed. Well, actually, I have been to Australia. I'm too young to remember what happened at the border gates. But I've mainly only travelled within North America and the EU, and so perhaps the more interesting experience travelling in those regions would be coming from a region like the Middle East or, you know, elsewhere in the Global South and seeing the reaction there.
Portugal usually is received quite well. I love always the process of applying for a visa because it's like, oh, it's Portugal. They can't harm anyone, right? Let's just let them in. But you're talking there about EU travel. I just had to renew my passport a couple of months ago. And as a citizen of an European Union country, Portugal, we have citizen cards as well. And it's just easier. It's like the size of a credit card. That's usually what I used to travel if I'm traveling within the EU. So I went to renew my passport and I realized I only had one stamp in it from like 7 years worth of traveling, because during those 7 years, 98% of my trips were within the EU. And I do at least, you know, a couple of trips a year, but I kind of miss that feeling of always getting a stamp. Just going back to that index for a bit, I was surprised. And not, but I was surprised to see Brazil at number 17. Interesting fact about Brazil, it's one of the most valuable passports in the black market, just because the country is so diverse, so ethnically diverse, that anyone can look Brazilian. So that's really the reasoning behind it. And that's why there's a huge clampdown in the black market to try not to sell Brazilian passports. And you might have seen that story this week about North Korea and fake Brazilian passports that apparently Kim Jong-un and his family were trying to get one, which was basically their photo with a different name. Of course, Brazil has a huge Asian population living in the country. And I was surprised that it was just a number 17 on this list.
Looking at the list, I did see in equal 19th place Andorra and San Marino, which did remind me of being in San Marino on assignment for Monocle last year and talking to people from that select aristocracy of San Marinese passport holders. And they all said it's actually a massive pest, because the number of places you go in the world where customs officials have literally never heard of the country and just assume that you've gone on the internet and ordered a sort of nonsense passport from some made-up fictional Ruritania, and you're having to explain, no, it may only be the size of a golf course and have a population of about 50 people, but it's actually a country. It's tough. But whereas the Australian one is actually quite a good one, because everybody has an idea of Australia. It's got the big cheerful kangaroo and emu on the front. And, yeah, it does seem to put people at their ease, weirdly.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's got... I think... Australia as a nation has a fairly benign stereotype around the world.
Will you be happier, Henry, post-Brexit when your passport is blue again? Will it make this all worth it?
I don't think I will be measurably happier, although I have followed the reaction to the announcement that the passport will change colour with great interest, because it seems to quite directly... What am I trying to say here? It's a cipher, I think, for the feelings on which the British public truly voted. And I think that it is frequently the case that the most trivial cosmetic
You're leaving the country, Henry. Let rip.
The most cosmetic components of national life actually command the greatest feeling and become ciphers for the greatest feeling for people about their countries.
And just in case anyone was curious, at the end of that list is, perhaps unsurprisingly, Afghanistan, number 105.
Below North Korea?
Yep, and only has a visa-free access to 24 countries in the world.
I did briefly, for a few days in 2003, own an Iraqi passport, which I bought from a gentleman who'd looted several boxes of them from the Ministry of the Interior, but it got taken off me at the Jordanian border. The customs guards had run out of sense of humour about such things by then. Never mind. But finally tonight, penguins. Everybody likes penguins. The good news is there are loads more of them than we thought. Boffins have discovered huge and hitherto unknown colonies of the creatures on the Danger Islands. Islands. What a fantastic name for a place. On the east side of the Antarctic Peninsula. First of all, does anybody here, in fact, not like penguins? Is there a contrarian view on penguins at this table?
Unanimous approval.
We've got 3 minutes. Someone come up with something.
No, actually, I think penguins are one of the animals that manages to garner most enthusiastic, fanatical support. I have a friend who's genuinely obsessed with penguins and he collects all sorts of penguin-related memorabilia. And
okay, because this is just sounding weird now.
Yeah.
No, and the reason why I'm saying this is because having had to buy her lots of presents in my time, it's always very easy to find penguin-themed objects around the world. So what I'm trying to say is I think penguins are a particularly popular animal.
Okay, so we're pleased that there are loads more penguins than we thought. That's excellent. But we did want to use this as a cue to reflect upon the unknown and undiscovered aspects of our planet. If there's a particular thing that you like about our planet pertaining to its vastness, my favourite is the federal electorate of Durham. In Western Australia, if it was a European country, it's three times bigger than France. It would be the biggest country in Europe by miles. It's one federal government constituency in Western Australia. There are 97,000 voters there.
That's fantastic. I think there are constituencies that can give you a run for your money in India,
There's a bigger one geographically, I think, Nunavut in Canada. I think I'm right in saying.
Really? Okay.
Colombia's Chiribiquete National Park, which just 2 weeks ago the president announced it was expanding, will now be the size of Denmark.
That's big. But I mean...
that's all I have for you.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can... I'm not sure... The penguins help me picture the size. Do you know what I mean? Penguins are something that I can imagine a million penguins.
You think of size measured in penguins.
Four penguins?
Whereas the rest of us would think of something in terms of square meters, you would think of, you know, how many.
I find it difficult to visualize. I understand that that's intellectually impressive, that fact about the kind of constituencies, but I like to imagine it.
There's also a formidable range in size. Does that not screw with your measurement slightly? Because whereas your Humboldt penguin or your rockhopper penguin are fairly stout creatures, your emperor penguin can nudge 6 feet.
But I have a consistently inaccurate fictional penguin in my head, so it doesn't matter how big actual penguins are.
The platonic idea of the penguin.
Indeed.
You're making the most of the blaze of glory on your last programme here. we have now learned after all this time that your head is inhabited by a fictional penguin. Does it have
That's
a name?
I'm acquitting myself. No, it's generic. It's generic. It's like a kind of, you know, those kind of to scale silhouettes that you get sometimes in infographics in The Economist. It's kind of like that. It doesn't even have any details. Just to come back to Chiara's point about
penguins
being one of the most kind of loved, and I know Andrew doesn't like this word, but I think it's appropriate here, iconic
birds
in human history. Jonathan Franzen, the writer, has a theory about why that is, and that is he thinks that penguins' waddle most closely resembles the gait of children in comparison to any other bird.
I think it is appropriate that we leave the last word to Henry Rhys Sheridan on what is, for the moment at least, his last appearance on Monocle 24. Henry Rhys Sheridan, Chiara Ramella and Carlotta Ribello, thanks as all for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Tom Hall with production support by the valiant, it says here, someone else has written in the script. I'm looking at you, Yolene Goffin and Bill Lutie. The researcher was James Kitchen. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Valiant, I ask you. In 30 minutes' time, there's a brand new episode of The Menu. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be your host for that as well. Now that's Valiant. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend.